Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic this hour is the future of the Bay Delta. It's been called the third rail of California politics, fraught with even more peril than Prop 13, if you can imagine that, and the most controversial proposal in the contentious history of California water. We're talking, of course, about the Bay Delta Conservation Plan and its proposed centerpiece, a massive conveyance system to move large amounts of water south out of the Sacramento River and around the ecologically fragile San Joaquin Sacramento River Delta. Proponents say that the project is essential for addressing risks of levee failure, reducing conflicts over fish, and ensuring reliable water deliveries to 25 million consumers in the Bay Area, the Central Valley, and Southern California, including Los Angeles. Opponents, on the other hand, say that the project is unaffordable, premised on unfair and unsustainable water allocations, and certain to do irreparable harm to fisheries, the Delta ecosystem, and the communities that depend on them. Meanwhile, Governor Brown has voiced support for the Delta conveyance and is expected to formalize his position in July, when he will publicly announce the key elements of the project. In the meantime, join us tonight as we parse out the pros and cons of the Delta debate. Do we need a peripheral canal, and at what cost? And what would be the environmental impacts of a water diversion scale program like this one? And what would be the project's impact for Bay Area ratepayers and taxpayers? And how you as listeners and potential ratepayers and taxpayers, how can you get involved in the discourse? Joining me tonight to discuss these questions and more are Gary Bobker. He's program director of the Bay Institute, a nonprofit organization committed to protecting and restoring the San Francisco Bay and its watershed. Welcome, Gary.
Well, thank you, Joe.
And we're also joined by Jason Peltier. He's Chief Deputy General Manager of Westlands Water District, a 600,000-acre agricultural district on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley, serving approximately 600 farms. Welcome, Jason.
Evening.
And we're also joined here in the studio by Joanne Maher. She is Deputy Operating Officer of the Santa Clara Valley Water District, which manages water resources for the 1.8 million residents of Santa Clara County. Welcome, Joan.
Thank you.
And by phone, we're joined by Barbara Barragan-Perea. She's Campaign Director for Restore the Delta, a nonprofit organization committed to promoting the health of the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta and the well-being of Delta communities. Welcome, Barbara.
Good evening, Joseph.
And to you, our listeners, I want to welcome you to join our conversation. In about 20 minutes, we'll open our phones and you can dial 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Post a comment on klw.org or a comment on our Facebook page. So we'll look forward to your comments and your calls in just a few minutes. But to begin the program, I want to start with you, Gary Bobker of the Bay Institute. Why don't you flesh out for us what the Bay Delta Conservation Plan is all about?
Sure. It's a work in progress. It's been going on for about 6 years. And it's an attempt by a number of parties, including folks who divert water from the Delta, government agencies, environmentalists, and other parties, to try and figure out what are the conditions under which we could permit operations of the big federal and state projects that take water out of the Delta for the next 50 years? In theory, if all things go right, you have a permit that would support the recovery of the endangered species of the Bay Delta, would support their habitats, and would also provide for a reliable water supply for 50 years. Unfortunately, 6 years into the process, we've got a plan that still has a long way to go. And, you know, part of the thing is that folks tend to immediately focus in on things like the peripheral canal element of it without asking the real question, which is, what's the problem we're trying to solve and what are the tools that we have for those solutions? The fact is that the peripheral canal isn't the cause of the problems, and it isn't necessarily the solution. You know, we have a system where we take a huge amount of water that used to flow to the bay. About half of the water that used to flow from the whole watershed to the bay is diverted, about a third of it before it reaches the Delta. And then when it reaches the Delta, about another fifth is taken by these big pumps. So that reduction in flow is one of the major drivers of the degradation of habitat and the decline of fish and wildlife species in the Bay Delta for the last few decades. On top of that, then you have these big pumps that cause reverse flows. They take a lot of fish every day. They create some real direct impacts. And so we need to deal with both the flow problem and the export impact problem. And at the same time, you've got water projects in the Delta, these big pumps that move water to the San Joaquin Valley and Southern California. And, you know, they're diverting right in the heart of a very environmentally sensitive area. Their diversions cause huge impacts. They also reduce flows, but they're also vulnerable. They're vulnerable because of the environmental disruption, and they're also vulnerable because of emerging threats like sea level rise, climate change, seismic risk in the Delta. So they're at risk, too, and we need to figure out a solution that works both for the species in the Delta and for these water users. That's where the dialogue is. And you have to look at what you're trying to accomplish rather than just jump to, is this particular solution, a peripheral canal, or that particular solution, the right one? What are you trying to do first? That's how you frame the conversation.
Hmm. Well, thanks for that outline. Jason Peltier from the Westlands Water District, I want to get your take on Gary's framing there, meaning specifically to talk about how is the problem defined, and what are the solutions, and what's your take on the Bay Area, Bay Delta Conservation Plan?
Well, I think it's important to step back, even from before where Gary started there, and talk about what is going on in this ecosystem and this water management system. We've got I think, pretty broad agreement. Barbara will disagree with me. We can all disagree on a whole lot of things, so let's just stipulate to that up front. But there's, I think, pretty broad agreement that conditions in the Delta are not sustainable on a number of fronts. The status quo cannot persist, and we're trying to plan our way towards the future as opposed to having more species collapse, more economic damage as a result of unreliable water supplies, earthquake seismic threat to the Delta that not only threatens the integrity of the Delta Islands, but also potentially the water supplies for a third of the irrigated land in the state and half the people. So it is against that backdrop of an unsustainable reality that we're in today that is driving us to try and find out, can we relocate the intakes to the pumps in a place where we can effectively screen the fish out and take the water and leave the fish in the system? Can we restore more land-water contact? Starting 150 years ago, what was a 500,000-acre swamp was converted over the years into a series of 75 islands. And that land-water contact that fed carbon into the bottom end of the food chain was disrupted. Can we create some more intertidal habitat? Well, there's almost none left. Can we deal with the stressors that are affecting the fish in the Delta? Can we find a way to deal with the reality that 95% or so of the aquatic biota of fish and plants is invasive, imported species? There's a whole lot of challenges we're trying to address. And in sum, we're excited about the reality that so much of the regulatory approach up to today has been, let's just focus on the pumps. And, you know, that we've given up an awful lot of water and have seen our water supply reliability for the last two decades cut and reduced. And so we've faced 40%, 60% up to 90% reductions in water supply in the San Joaquin Valley. That's not a sustainable reality for our economy.
And tell us how you think the plan, as it's currently formulated, is going to address some of the things you're just describing.
We have a series of conservation measures. The isolated conveyance is one. We have plans to deal with toxics and predators and just a whole bunch of the factors that are out there. And Gary is certainly right. It's not. We've got a long ways to go. But we have some huge institutional and scientific problems to deal with in terms of dealing with the uncertainty of the science. Gary thinks it's flow. I disagree. Gary thinks the pumps have a big impact on fish populations. I disagree. I know, certainly we take fish, but we can't find a population level effect when we do our analysis of it. so this we're kind of today in a place where the responsible government agencies and individuals in those agencies are kind of frozen over this scientific uncertainty, and it's a common phenomenon we see in any big societal problem. Is it's hard to make decisions when you don't know what the result is going to be. You don't know what the effect of that decision is going to be on what species, you know, not only today but 50 years out.
And Barbara Barragan-Puria, I want to bring you in next. Your campaign director for Restore the Delta. Jason's comments there talk about restoring the land, saving the fish, creating and managing the habitat, and trying to do it with an imperfect amount of scientific evidence to guide decisions moving forward. What's your take on that? Is it he's talking things that seem pretty reasonable to be concerned about and wanting to move forward in a way that will help farmers and people who depend on water in the southern parts of this state. And it sounds like there's not a lot of coming together just yet around this from the two sides. What's wrong with the way he's describing this?
Well, first, what I would like to say is I actually agree with Jason that conditions in the Delta presently cannot be sustained. The Delta is an estuary that has been in decline, but the truth is, it's a jewel in the rough that just needs some polishing. The comments that the BDCP plan has put forward will actually create restoration just simply don't hold water. What the peripheral canal will do, or the new conveyance with the plan, is it will reroute water in California out of the Delta to support the top 1% of corporate agribusiness growers, like in the Westlands Water District. It will leave water ratepayers and taxpayers on the hook for the largest multi-billion-dollar public work project in the history of California. And it won't restore the estuary because the estuary cannot be restored by having its major primary freshwater source diverted from it. As the Bay Institute, Gary noticed, and has made clear in recent documents, you know, flows into the Delta and out of the Delta are absolutely crucial for restoration. Fish screening is absolutely imperative at the pumps. During the CalFed process, fish screens were promised by the water exporters that were never put into place. This year, we've had probably the highest number of kill at the pumps, the record number for some species like split tail. So it's important to know that the canal, besides being too expensive, it's just not going to make more water that's needed for the state.
And now I want to turn to Joan Marr at the Santa Clara Valley Water District. I wanted to hear from you if you then try to bring it home for the homeowner, the renter, whoever is sort of not the farmer, not the big the big interests in this, but the individual interests for the people you serve in Santa Clara County. How can you frame this conversation in terms of the impact of this plan going forward or the impact of this plan not going forward for people in Santa Clara County, just to give us a sense of bringing it home literally?
Okay. I think one of the things that we're you know, in Silicon Valley, which is in the South Bay area, that's our service area. Silicon Valley is very important to the Bay Area and to the rest of the state as well. As a homeowner, what I care about is when I go to turn on the faucet, drinking water comes out of my faucet. Good, clean, reliable drinking water. I care about my job. I care about the economy, that the economy is good enough to support the populations in the state, and I think that what we're looking for in this in the Bay Delta Conservation Plan is to stabilize and protect our water supplies, as well as the quality of our water supplies. We're looking to protect the economy. We're looking to protect the Delta ecosystem from further decline. So I would agree that the status quo is not acceptable. I think that's one thing everybody does agree on. I would also say that agree with Barbara that we're not looking to this plan to necessarily produce more water for Santa Clara. We're looking for a reliable supply. So one thing that we've learned over the past few years, as the process has gone forward and as science has evolved, is the risk of the Delta. We've learned that there is a two-thirds chance of major Delta Island failure, which would compromise water quality and water supply for an extended period of time. So we're looking to address that particular risk. The facilities that are being proposed are not really there to, we're not proposing to operate them in a way that would take more water out of the Delta beyond restoring what we've lost in recent years because of regulatory shortages. So those are the kinds of things that we're looking for. I would say the science is not perfect. It's improving. And one of the things that we have to deal with in this plan is it's a 50-year plan. It's hard for people to make decisions when you don't know what's going to happen over that 50-year period. You don't have absolute certainty. But we have to find a way to move forward in a framework that helps people deal with adaptive changes over time, and that gives us the flexibility to deal with basically deal with changing conditions for fish as well as future challenges like climate change and water supply impacts from that. So,
and Gary, you had your hand up earlier. I want to get back to you, but and first say this idea of not being able to predict the next 50 years or that the science is going to be uncertain and we can't wait for science that's not going to arrive to help guide decisions. What do you make of that claim that there's not enough science or the science is not knowable and so we can't wait for it?
Well, I think this is one of the best studied estuaries in the world. I think we've got a wealth of knowledge about it. It's a complex system. It's a changing system. So that means that we can't just sit on our laurels about what we know and not react to change over 50 years. And, you know, 50 years is a tough sell. But, you know, if we do it right, if we focus on defining what the goals are and managing to those goals and making sure that the permits are enforceable so that you are managing to those goals, then maybe you can do it over 50 years. But you've got a pretty rock-solid basis of knowledge to go on now. And I want to get back to that fundamental disagreement that Jason and I and water users and environmentalists or exporters and environmentalists have. And that is that, you know, we often talk about the importance of flow in the system. It's not because we think that flow is the only important thing in the Bay Delta Estuary or any ecosystem. There are a number of things that are important: flow, habitat, water quality, invasive species, etc. But we can agree on many of those and on the things to do about them. But flow is the area where, number one, the science tells us that it is probably the most important single driver in defining aquatic habitat. We know that the more flow there is in the system, the more abundant fish and wildlife populations are. This is just one of the best known facts about the system. And so to leave it out of the equation, as is often the case with these planning processes like BDCP, that's a real problem. We're essentially not dealing with one of the most fundamental problems. So that's why it goes back to what might have sounded like a non sequitur earlier, and that is, let's frame the issue before we talk about the peripheral canal. The fact is that the peripheral canal is not going to solve the flow problem. We divert too much water now. Whether we take it from the South Delta pumps the way we do now, or we divert it from the North Delta if we build a new peripheral tunnel, we have to change that. We have to start looking at ways that we can put more flow in the system from more users throughout all of California, because not everybody contributes to solving the problem of putting flows in the rivers and into the Delta. And we have to look at ways to reduce exports and get exporters on different supplies. The one area where a facility has some justification is in dealing with the export problem, the direct impacts of taking fish at the pumps. You have to remember that, not only do we lose fish at the pumps, but there are calculations that anywhere from 10 to 15% of your conservative, up to 95% of your, you know, if, based on some recent studies, of fish that are attracted to the pumps are lost before they're ever salvaged, you know, before they actually get to the pumps. It's a huge problem. The peripheral canal, or changing the where we take water, could address some of that. Basically, you're removing the pumps from the South Delta so that the San Joaquin River habitat improves, the South Delta, the Central Delta, where the heart of all these resident species that live all the time in the Delta, you could reduce the impacts of pumping on those species. You may shift some of those impacts to the Sacramento River, so you may be trading, you know, some, you know, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, but there, you know, in other words, there are potential benefits there. But if, as Jason says, you know, there's real questions about whether export pumps really cause those problems, well, then you're undermining actually, you know, one of the main reasons for building a peripheral tunnel for environmental purposes. There are other reasons to look at a peripheral tunnel or canal, and that has to do with the vulnerability of the system. And one of the other big disagreements here is, you know, just how vulnerable the system is. You know, Barbara makes a pretty strong case that there are things you can do in the Delta to deal with levee stability where you don't have, you know, that'll be enough to solve the problem. There are other folks who say, well, no, the risk is really big and we can't afford that problem. But, you know, it's those kinds of issues that really get at the meat of whether a peripheral tunnel has to be part of the solution or not. But to me, if a peripheral tunnel increases the amount of water that we divert from the system or just maintains what we have now, then essentially you're saying that ecosystem uses are going to continue to decline no matter what the fate of the water supply system is.
Hmm. In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. We're local public radio, and tonight we're discussing the proposed peripheral canal in the Bay Delta with our guest Gary Bobker, Program Director of the Bay Institute, Barbara Barragan-Perea, Campaign Director for Restore the Delta, Jason Peltier, Chief Deputy General Manager of Westlands Water District, and Joan Maher. She is Deputy Operating Officer for the Santa Clara Valley Water District. And we invite you, our listeners, to join in with your questions and comments at this time by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on our KLW page or our Facebook page, 415-841-4134, to call us in the studio. So, Jason, I wanted to have you respond, to Gary's comments, specifically about, does flow matter? And he believes that flow does matter quite a bit here. And on this question of how fragile is the Delta, and is the peripheral canal the solution, or can there be other things that could help build up the fragility of that area to not only keep the ecosystem intact, but to make sure that there's a supply of water that's reliable.
Certainly, I agree with Gary on the reality that this is a very data-rich environment we're working in. We've had government has been and water users have been investing in science in the Delta at a clip of $15 to $30 million a year for the last 30+ years. So we have a lot of knowledge. We have a tremendous amount of monitoring data and scientific research data. So we've got knowledge, but it's not translating into understanding. There's big disagreements over how the system operates, and the flow issue is front and center and one of those things that we debate and argue over a lot.
What's your stand on that?
Of course flow matters. We are highly regulated. We've got the State Water Resource Control Board, the Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act. We've got a whole lot of regulatory pressures breathing down on us and controlling that where the water goes. The thing I miss with Gary's point is, you tell me, you know, where the water's needed, when it's needed, and what good it's going to do, and we can have a real conversation. We can't ever, it seems, get into that conversation. You know, the fact is that today, about 80% of the water that flows into the Delta goes to the ocean. The other reality is, when and if we build isolated conveyance, that same reality is going to exist. So we could do a lot of damage to the economy and society in California by saying you're going to take 5% less water out of the Delta than you take today. And on one hand, on the other hand, so certain economic destruction. On the other hand, highly uncertain whether that would be of any value to the fish. I would like to also, Gary made the point about salmon being pulled to the pumps. Well, that's one of the real complicating factors we've got to deal with here, is that the entire delta is tidal. In the western part of the delta, about the Antioch Bridge, you've got 300,000 cubic feet per second sloshing in and out every twice a day. We've got tidal effect all the way to Sacramento. And so, yeah, there's a lot of reverse flows that go on constantly there. So it's not like some slack water lake where you turn the pumps on and, you know, the fish get pulled over there. The fact is, or our understanding is, the salmon that get pulled in, that move into the central part of the delta, are not pulled in by the pumps. They're brought in by currents, tides, and at junctions around islands where the flows split. They're not killed by the pumps. They're killed by the predators. Gary talked about some numbers. I'd never heard them that high relative to losses of fish at the pumps. But another reality, if you look at downstream migrating salmon on the San Joaquin and the Sacramento Rivers, there are astronomical losses as associated with.
I'm going to move predators. You on to Go the ahead. Other question, yes, which sir. Is how, and in terms of things besides the canal, why is the canal so important to the ability to create sustainable water resources, as opposed to doing other things to support the delta and the levees?
Well,
therein,
from our perspective, the perspective of our farmers, the canal is not the outcome. That's not the goal. Isolated conveyance isn't the goal. The goal is reliability and predictability and certainty and knowing how much you can invest in this year's crop because you know what your water supply is going to be. Operationally, as Gary pointed out, currently we have a configuration where the state project and the federal water projects both pump out near Tracy. It's the sump end of the delta, and we collect fish, we can't screen them out and leave them behind because they just would accumulate in front of the screen. So that's why for decades we've looked at relocating the intakes of the pumps up to the Sacramento River where there's a good flow going by and you can have a positive fish screen and separate the water effectively that way.
So, Barbara, I wanted to get you in here. What do you think about this issue of flow and fragility of the delta? I think I know where you stand. I just want to hear your thoughts on the comments you've heard so far.
Well, again, going back to the flow issue, the delta will die a death of 1,000 cuts if more water flow isn't put back into the delta. With a peripheral canal and the diversion of our major freshwater source, the Sacramento River, we believe that would be the final death blow to the delta. In terms of the arguments that are being sold about the fragility of the delta, I would suggest the listeners take a look at the Delta Protection Commission's economic sustainability plan that was published several months ago. In it, there's a wonderful analysis by Dr. Bob Pike, who is considered one of the foremost experts in California on levees within the state. And he goes through the costs and what levees really do need work, and he's determined that it's going to cost about $1 to $2 billion to bring delta levees up to robust standards. Such robust standards would really provide the protection that's needed, one, to secure the delta as a water source for water exports. But you have to remember, whether you build the canal or not, those levee investments have to be made because you have 4 million people in delta communities living behind those levees. And you have over $20 billion worth of infrastructure within the delta that needs to be protected, including highways, railroad lines, transmission lines. So fixing the levees is actually a very smart investment. The delta is also well-situated to be able to increase levee size to deal with climate change and sea level rise because that won't happen overnight. Sea level rise is predicted to be more gradual, and that is something that can actually be responded to by delta engineers. The primary threat to the delta has been and always will be flood, the possibility of flood. And what was particularly interesting is this last week, the Delta Protection Commission sponsored a forum. And at that forum, it became clear that the Department of Water Resources is actually promoting, with the BDCP, a weaker standard for levee protection for the delta than what is recommended by the Army Corps of Engineers. And we find that very troubling. It seems to be a shift in that we just have to do the minimum because we can build the project and send the water to other parts of the state. When the investment still has to be made to protect people and property within the Delta.
So do you see a situation in which you could get the co-equal goals here met, both of water reliability and the Delta sustainability, without a canal?
This is what we believe at Restore the Delta. We believe that safe yields, what science and good science determines is the correct amount of water that can be shared, is the amount of water we should share. We believe that there are other projects in the state that promote regional self-sufficiency, and that the key to success for the Delta to fully thrive once again is to break dependence on the Delta. I understand that the farmers in the Westlands Water District are concerned about reliability, but the issue that's not being addressed there is that when the Central Valley Project was built, it was built with the understanding that they were going to grow crops like tomatoes and lettuce. The majority of those crops have been replaced with almonds, crops that require water every year and have to be watered during dry periods. Drought is a regular part of the water system in California. We have dry periods and wet periods. We think there have to be better ways to get water to other parts of the state during wet times, to have it put underground through conjunctive use and then brought up back to the surface for use during those periods. It's also worth considering that a good deal of land in the Central Valley, particularly through Westlands, that doesn't drain properly, that is polluted with selenium and boron, where the Central Valley Project drain was never put in by the federal government, should really be just looked and considered for retirement for production. It doesn't make sense to spend so much money in subsidizing water for polluted land when the Delta is made up of 500,000 acres of prime agricultural land and has an economic value every year equal to that of Westlands.
And Joan Maher from the Santa Clara Valley Water District, I want to bring you in here with this idea of trying to decrease or eliminate dependency on the Delta for consumers in your district.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to make two observations. One is on the notion that we should armor the levees in the Delta and then that will be our solution. In some ways, I think that's almost as impractical as you could have it, because there's 1,100 miles of levees. Certainly, we believe that many of those levees are important to protect infrastructure. Even with an isolated facility, we know that we need to make investments in the Delta. But that solution alone is not basically not the best solution for fish either. When you look at creating new habitat in the Delta, armoring the levees doesn't allow you to build the amount of habitat that is needed for fish. As far as reducing reliance on the Delta, in our area, for example, Santa Clara County, 55% of our supply is imported. 40% of it comes through the Delta. The other 15% is Hetch Hetchy supplies, which originate in the Delta watershed. We have made large investments in conservation and recycled water. We're continuing to make those investments. Currently, we conserve about 52,000 acre feet of water a year. No amount of conservation or recycled water in the future is really going to replace our Delta supplies. So that is, wishful thinking, basically, to think that we can replace, totally reduce our reliance. I will say, since 1990, though, our investments in recycled water and conservation have resulted in our county has grown in population by 300,000 people over the last 20 years, and we have reduced the amount of water that we've used each year by, as I said, by 50,000 acre feet. So, it can be done. We've been reducing our reliance on the Delta since for the last 20 years, and we'll continue to do that.
This is City Visions on 91.7 Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about the Bay Delta Conservation Project with our guests, Gary Bobker, Program Director of the Bay Institute, Barbara Barragan-Perea, Campaign Director for Restore the Delta, Jason Peltier, Chief Deputy General Manager of Westlands Water District, and Joanne Marr. She is Deputy Operating Officer of the Santa Clara Valley Water District. We invite you, our listeners, to dial in with your questions and comments at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on klw.org or our Facebook page. And we'll get to some of those emails in just a moment. But first, Gary, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that point about dependency. But I want to start with a factual correction. I mean, the scale of our alteration of the hydrology of the system is actually on the order of about 50%. I mean, we divert, on average, about half of the water in the watershed. And in some years and in some seasons, that can be as high as 70% or more. It's a huge problem. But you know, one of the ways to stop arguing over every drop of water and be able to move toward putting more flow back in the system and meeting needs is to reduce our reliance on the Delta. And you know, one I think a sterile argument to have is to argue whether you can completely eliminate your reliance on the Delta. Because I think that's something you said, Joan, that I think we don't start with the assumption that it's 100% or nothing. But we need to make a decision. A political decision, is it good policy to reduce reliance on the Delta? Well, in fact, in the Delta Reform Act of 2009, the state of California has said that is the policy of the state going forward.
And that's our policy as well.
So the question is, what really is an aggressive approach to that? How far can we push that? And one of my problems with the state of the Bay Delta plan as it is now is that we haven't really plumbed the depths of that. I think we can do a lot more than the assumption that, you know, we have to solve it all in the Delta. I mean, you cannot solve both ecosystem and water supply problems on the back of the Delta. It's just going to break. But if we really do aggressive conservation, I mean, the potential for conservation, even using conservative estimates from the state itself, is immense. You know, you've got a number of new reservoirs from the virtual equivalent of reservoirs from doing water use efficiency in both the ag and urban sector, from doing groundwater management, desalination, et cetera. None of them by itself is a panacea. And together they can really make a difference. Now, if you could reduce our use of Delta water for export by a significant amount, by 25 or 50%, you know, you could solve the problem right there. Are we capable of doing that? Well, we need to look at how close we can get to that. And then we can look at, okay, what does this mean for the amount of water that we know we need to keep going through the Delta? What does that say for the sizing of a facility if we decide to build a new facility? You know, what does it mean for the vulnerability of the system? If we build a facility in the Delta, is the system invulnerable in the rest of the system? You know, we need to look at sort of as a whole. And so a lot of that analysis hasn't been done. That's where I get concerned that we not just jump to the solution before we fully analyze the problem.
And Joan.
Yeah, as you know, there's two components of, there's the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, which is focused on restoring the Delta ecosystem and reliable conveyance through the Delta. There is the Delta Plan established by the 2009 Delta Reform Act. That has that broader perspective, and I agree, the solution must be the whole picture. I'm just saying from a practical perspective, the more that you implement conservation, the more you implement recycled water, your remaining supplies become much more important that they be reliable. That's the hardening of demand. So your tolerance for any outage or disruption becomes much less.
Yes, Barbara.
I would like to add, well, two points. I completely agree that, you know, we're not, with Gary, that we're not asking for complete elimination of exports from the Delta. But the fact is that about 60 to 70% of the water that is taken from the Delta through the Central Valley Project and the State Water Project actually goes to big corporate agribusiness in the Westlands Water District and in Kern County. If all we had to share with were urban water users who are making great progress in urban water conservation, things would improve in the Delta. I also wanted to bring up a point about the levees. 1,100 miles of the Delta levees are not in fragile condition. In fact, historically, we've had fewer levee breaks in the last 30 years than in the entire history of the Delta. It's estimated that about 300 to 400 miles of the delta in that report by the Delta Protection Commission needs improvements to hit robust standards. A robust levee is a fat levee, and there is much potential on those type of levees for doing habitat restoration.
So, Jason, I think you need to answer here. What are ratepayers in your district doing to decrease their dependence on Delta water?
Tremendous amount of investments occurred over the last 20 years as our water supply has been cut through environmental regulations. We've taken 100,000 acres of land out of production. We've seen we're probably at 80-plus percent on drip or micro-irrigation today. And, yes, we've shifted to more higher-value crops because our water costs are some of the highest that ag sees in the state. And in order to go into the market to buy additional water, we need to grow almonds and lettuce and things that are of greater value. I do want to get back to the this notion of the flows because Gary might be right on average, but the reality is if you look at this year, we've got Shasta almost ready to go into flood control operations, Folsom Reservoir certainly in flood operations, dumping water to the ocean today. Inflow to the delta is about 35,000 cubic feet per second. The two pumping plants are moving about 2,000 CFS. And if you look at 2009, when we were at 10% supply, for 5 months, virtually 100% of the delta outflow came from reservoirs, reservoir releases. So you've got to look at it across the years, and we certainly recognize that there's going to be years of shortages, but there's tremendous amount of water today that is not being put to use, and the economy is suffering. I think, you know, this whole conversation is clouded by mythology a lot of times, and it's even more clouded when we hear Restore the Delta talking about, you know, corporate entities, corporate farms, and let's have a class warfare conversation about who are the most entitled and who's the bad guys. And I think that really is a disservice to the whole conversation. I'm not aware of a single corporate entity. There's family corporations, but a corporate entity that farms in Westlands. If Barbara thinks that by throwing that charge out, she's somehow going to convince people that, yeah, we really are evil and we shouldn't be producing food and fiber down in Westlands, I think she's misreading the public pretty bad.
Barbara, do you want to have a brief response to that?
Well, you know, I guess the most interesting point to me that Jason said was that part of their improvement in farming techniques was to deal with reduced water was to take 100,000 acres out of production. According to a report by the California Water Associates, those 100,000 acres were taken out of production due to drainage impairment because it's land that should have never been irrigated as intensely as it has been.
And how about this issue about mischaracterizing the farmers in the Westlands Valley in the Westlands district?
If you look at reports done by Lloyd Carter on his blog, you will see that there may be 600 farmers in the Westlands Water District, but they have combined assets in families. So there's basically 50 to 60 corporate entities that really profit. They're growing cotton and still and receiving subsidies for subsidized cotton. They're exporting almonds that do not feed people in this country. And, can the food that they produce be produced elsewhere without having a real negative impact on the economy? Truth is, Westlands Water District contributes probably about 1.5% to the state economy.
Jason, one last comment back on that, and then we're going to have to move on from
sure.
this topic. Any comments to Barbara's last comments?
If she wants to, you know, if we as a society want to pick winners and losers and say, those farmers over there, we're going to take them out of business. That's a big societal decision that needs to be made. As it is today, we've got a system of water rights, water law, contracts, commitments, all started and it's founded on the notion that water allows our economy to grow. It allows us to grow food that's good, even if it's for foreign trade, that's good. I don't get questioning how those, that those are somehow bad values, that somebody in Mendota is of less importance than somebody in Stockton or San Francisco.
problem is, Jason, that you want a situation where the water is taken from Delta farmers, and those Delta family farmers have seniority and water rights over the Westlands Water District.
Well, no, that's not the case. We want water that's developed by the Central Valley Project in Shasta, Folsom, Trinity, that we are responsible for repaying that infrastructure. We just want access to the water that we have. The project has superior old rights to, and we're not about taking any water away from anybody that's using it legally.
Gary, just a brief sort of comment on this, and that is that the issue. I'm not going to try to characterize the West Side growers. I'll just note that even if Westlands Water District was operated by Occupy protesters growing organic vegetables, 100% of their crop, it still would be an unsustainable water sector. I mean, we need to look at the contract commitments that were made at levels that you really can't deliver on, and figure out levels that are environmentally sensible and are reliable, so that the growers know with a much greater certainty than they do today what they can get.
And let's go back to this other issue now that we haven't really touched upon all that much, but how much is all this expected to cost, Gary?
Well, you should ask Jason. He's paying for it. Well, you know, the estimates have grown amazingly over the years since we started this. I think they originally were talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of, $5 or $8 billion. I think we're up to between 10 and 20, depending on who you talk to, for facilities, plus a couple of billion for habitat. And, you know, part of what we need to do is we need to look at, if you're going to look at facilities, what's the optimized size of facilities? So you have to get back to the issue of, what's the reliable water supply that is sustainable environmentally? And you have to look at alternatives. To what extent should we be investing in a Manhattan Project style drought proofing of these districts to the extent that we can, understanding that, what's left is a hardened demand, as Joan points out. We need to look at the cost of doing a bunch of different things altogether. The fact is it's not levees versus facilities. We've got to protect some of the levees in the Delta, critical levee places where the levees need to be improved. And we've got to, the facilities we have now just aren't very smart. So we've got to do improvements to those facilities. Whether it's a peripheral tunnel or not is a second question. But we've got to do a lot of different things, but we may be able to do it a lot more cost effective than the kind of price tag we're looking at now, which I just don't think is realistic under any financial scenario, even a rosier one.
Haven't heard a dollar amount, though. Jason, do you want to give us a dollar amount?
That's... Sure. There is a range. I usually say the isolated facility is about $12 billion, and we'll add on another $3 to $4 of public money to invest in habitat restoration and improvement projects. I've seen some reports that say that would translate to $150 an acre foot of water going out of the Delta. I don't know if we can afford it in the end. The project is not yet been defined. Every turn of the screw is another burden being placed on this, either on the ecosystem side or on the water project operation side, where we're seeing less and less benefits. And if we're going to end up with a project that conveyance that cost $12 billion that just gets us back to kind of where we were before the last biological opinion under the Endangered Species Act, we can't convince our customers that they can make that investment. We can't convince the bond rate entities that we're going to sell bonds for us that it's a valid expense. Then we have to ask ourselves, so what do we do if we can't afford it? If the endangered species regulators say you've got to meet all these burdens, all these bypass flows, you're not going to really be able to operate this facility very much, what's the next plan? We're not going to just give up and say, yeah, that was a good try, and throw our values out the window and the things that we want for our communities and society to just all of a sudden say those are irrelevant. We're not going to do that. We're going to keep going until we find a way to get a reliable water supply. That's kind of that's our business. That's what our customers expect of us.
Joan?
I guess when I look at the affordability of Bay Delta Conservation Plan, I think about can we afford not to make this kind of an investment in the Delta? I mean, what's the alternative? You wait until there's a catastrophic failure of some kind that we have, you know, plenty of money gets poured in to recover. The cost of shortages is tremendous, particularly through, you know, to the urban sector. And as far as $12 or $13 billion being spread over 25 million Californians, I think one thing you can look at, it's not unheard of, for example, in the Hetch Hetchy project, they have a $4.6 billion CIP to invest in reliability of that system spread over 2.5 million people in the Hetch Hetchy project area. So, you know, when you look at the scale of, yes, $12 or $13 billion sounds like a lot of money, but when you look at the beneficiaries and you look at the cost of not making that investment, it's pretty obvious that it's, you know, the benefits exceed the costs. So,
And Barbara, do you want to weigh in on the cost issue?
Well, you know, if it were only $12 or $13 billion, it might be a little bit more palatable to the public. But Dr. Jeff Michael from the Business Forecasting Center at UOP today, I was at a conversation with him where he ran through an analysis of the BDCP. And what's being left out is that $12 to $13 billion for construction of the canal, according to the BDCP, possibly up to $23 billion once you put in all the environmental mitigation of the project. And then a 40-year payback rate on those bonds, plus another $100 million to operate the project, would put us at $1.2 billion a year for 40 years, in addition to what investments are made up front. This is the largest proposed public works project in the history of California, and yet the BDCP does not have a cost-benefit analysis in it. There's been no evaluation made of what are the real benefits from moving water versus what we stand to lose from commercial fishing on the coast of California, from the impacts to the estuary, recreational fishing, and delta agriculture, versus what the real cost of this project will be. And ratepayers and California taxpayers have the right to know.
Okay, Jason, quick comment. We're going to go to a couple of calls.
Okay. What is known is that about $400 million worth of the state's economy is driven every year by $400 billion worth of the state's economy is driven every year by water that moves out of the Delta South. That's what's at risk, $400 billion plus.
So let's go next to some callers. And first we'll go to, I'm sorry, it's Mark. Sorry, Mark outside of Sacramento. Welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Mark Rockwell. Are you talking to me?
Yes, we are.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to raise the question, and Barbara just alluded to it. And that question is, in this, as Jason put it, class warfare conversation, which I don't think any of us really think about it that way. But what was left out of that whole conversation was the impacts that have occurred and continue to occur on the commercial and recreational fishing communities in California. And that's not just individual fishermen and their businesses and their fishing boats that have really plied the Pacific Ocean for 150 years, but it also impacts the communities up and down the coastline that are dependent on those fishermen, both recreational and commercial, as well as guides and outfitters and all the businesses that are dependent on them in the Central Valley. So a system that takes too much water that causes the fisheries to crash, it's just a system that doesn't work for a lot of communities in California. So my question is, what's the guarantee that this BDCP agreement is going to be managed in a way that doesn't kill the commercial and recreational fishing communities in our state?
Thanks so much, Mark, for your call. Jason, do you want to take that?
There's no guarantees in life, that's for sure. But if we don't address some of the realities of the stressors that the salmon are facing, like predation coming downstream, you know, maybe 15% of the fish even get to the Delta because there are predators out there that are just waiting for them. If we don't address toxics like 12 tons of ammonia every day coming into the system, adversely affecting the bottom end of the food chain, if we don't address, and I know this is really a hard one, but if we don't address the reality that in areas of the Delta, there's 40,000 invasive clams per square meter, they're filter feeders, they're knocking the bottom end of the food chain out that is important to migrating salmon. If we don't address any of those things, no amount of flow is going to make a difference.
Gary, you wanted to add something there?
Well, I want to thank the caller for reminding us that, you know, the job losses in the fishery industry have been real and devastating and quite a large scale. And if you look at the numbers, they're actually comparable to the numbers that get thrown out for other industries. You know, there are many different challenges. There are a lot of things we have to do, and it's not all in the Delta. There are things we have to do upstream in terms of fish passage, water quality, et cetera. But at the end of the day, if you have reduced flows, what happens is that every year you have conditions in which the population shrinks instead of growing. And what flow conditions tend to do is that the more flow you have, you create bigger habitat areas, you create better habitat conditions, the population grows. And so in the long term, you maintain the stability of those populations. And that's not what we have now. So if you want to have a recovered salmon fishery, you've got to do that. You've also got to deal with, and again, you know, we can argue over the specific numbers, but we know for a fact that today the pumps in the South Delta take millions of fish each year. They take tens of millions of eggs, larvae, and juveniles. You know, we've got to do something about that.
And we have an email from Matt who says, I believe the idea of a peripheral canal was overwhelmingly voted down last time it was put to voters. Why is this not coming? Well, first of all, why is it coming up again? And then why is it not coming up for a vote again in front of the voters? Do you want to take a stab at that, Gary?
Well, I think that there's a couple of things in play. I mean, one, very simply, is that, Governor Brown's back, and he tried once, and I think he's a persistent fellow. But also, you know, there are arguments for a peripheral facility. I mean, you know, if as I think, the export pumps are damaging, if we want a more reliable water supply, there are some good arguments you can make for changing the facilities. But again, we don't deal with the underlying problems. That's the point I've made ad nauseum, and I won't make it again now. So that's one. But the other thing is that there's just a growing sense of frustration. The ecosystem is collapsing. I mean, we've listed, what, 7 or 8 species as endangered under the federal and state Endangered Species Acts. We've got a system that is not able to support itself anymore. We're in a crisis mode. That crisis mode is not just for water users. It is actually most egregious for the environment right now. So there's a dissatisfaction with the status quo. We need to do something different. That's part of the reason why people are interested in new solutions like the peripheral canal or tunnel. The problem is you got to think carefully about what problem you're trying to solve and what solution tools you have before you jump to one.
And as we wrap up, I'm going to stay with you for saying, where do you see this moving forward from the conversation here tonight and others that you've heard? What are some ways in which the two sides can come closer to a solution?
Well, I think one thing is that, the latest sort of versions of the plan that have come out this year have gotten wrapped pretty bad by reviewers in the agencies, the stakeholders, independent science review panels. And I think there's a growing realization that, you know, if people want a solution, and I think everybody does, we're going to have to do better. And so it's my hope that we're really going to start to address those underlying issues I talked about, deal with, integrate the flow issues with the conveyance issues in our analysis, start to think about what is it we really need to do for the environment in conjunction with the kind of habitat things that we're talking about. And the other thing is link what we're doing in the Delta to outside the Delta. So this whole issue of if we're going to break dependency or reduce reliance, what does that mean? To what extent are we capable of weaning ourselves off the Delta? What kind of costs are entailed in that? And that actually gives us a better sense of what the boundaries are that we're playing with. We're not there now.
So it sounds like there's a lot more to come, and I'm not sure how patient the people, the stakeholders in this room and out there are for those answers to come. And perhaps we're going to have several shows more on this topic to break down a lot of the various pieces that we just introduced you to tonight. So that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Gary Bobker, Program Director of the Bay Institute, Barbara Barragan Paria, Campaign Director for Restore the Delta, Jason Peltier, he's Chief Deputy General Manager of Westlands Water District, and Joan Maher, Carr. She is Deputy Operating Officer of the Santa Clara Valley Water District. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you, Joe.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit our new City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. Join my co-host Lauren Meltzer next Monday as we discuss how the web has influenced trends in travel. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.